Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. As part of our continuing Environmental Outlook series, the history, politics, economics, and future of water. In a new book titled Water and subtitled The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization, Stephen Solomon describes the pivotal role of water in the rise and fall of great powers. He's with me in the studio for a discussion of the global water challenges of our time. Also here in the studio, Julia Bucknell. She's manager of the Central Water Unit at the World Bank, and Jeff Dabelko. He's director of the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. I know many of you have asked us to focus on water, so here we are. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Steve, let me start with you. How come you decided to use water as the lens through which to gaze at history?
Well, no one had ever done that before, and we all know how important oil had been in shaping the 20th century. And when you started to look at the role of water in the 21st century, you began to see it underlying many of the crises that we were facing. That is, a lot of failing states, were in trouble because they couldn't feed their populations. There were about a billion people that didn't have enough access to clean drinking water, and 2.5 billion without sanitation that was adequate. And that was a public health crisis. So as you began to look at it, you began to see that just as oil shaped the 20th century, water scarcity problems were going to affect very much the geopolitics, economy, and social life of the 21st century.
Do you see us at any kind of a turning point today?
Yes, because our water ecosystems are being used in unsustainable ways. We've had a population water has increased twice as fast as human population in the last two centuries. And with we're really at the point where our 6.5 billion people on Earth don't really have enough water, given the way we use it currently, for all their needs, much less the 9 billion that we're becoming. So we're facing both an environmental crisis if we don't get our arms around the water problem, and a whole host of political and economic and social problems.
Jeff Dabelko, do you see water as the new oil for the coming years?
Well, I certainly agree with Steve in terms of the priority and the fact that we haven't had nearly as much attention to the water issue as it deserves, and certainly has been given oil. In many ways, I would suggest we don't even have to compare them and say one is more important than the other. But I would settle for seeing it, having it in the same kind of conversation that we have about oil, and maybe even a quarter of the attention that we give to oil, because that would be a dramatic increase in how much attention and priority and resources that we're giving to the water issue.
Julia, what's the scope of the water problem as you see it?
Well, I think there are two problems. One is a organizational and a financial problem associated with getting water to the people who need it and can use it best at the time that they need it. And then there's a second problem, which is a resource problem, which is managing the entire system so that you can get the resources on which we depend to make productive use of the water. For example, if you don't maintain some forests, you don't have habitats for insects, who then need to pollinate your crops that you're going to be irrigating with your water. So this whole integrated system needs to be managed in a much more holistic fashion.
Now, talk about Haiti. In the sense of the water crisis it's facing now.
Well, clearly there's a two-stage problem. The first is the basic needs issue, and basic needs are absolutely essential, as I mean everybody knows. I mean that is the issue right now, is making sure that people have access to clean drinking water, water that they can wash in, and making sure that you get rid of the wastewater so that the diseases don't spread. And then in the longer term, the resource issue is much more about making sure that you can build a new city that is protected from storm surges, from floods, from inundations, and making sure that you plan the layout of the land, the upstream management of the catchment, and all of the system so that you are less vulnerable to future disasters.
Steve Solomon, as we talk about water, do you think that the world is focused on water in ways it has been on oil?
Not yet, and not nearly to the degree that it must be. We had a pretty good meeting, however, in Davos with the World Economic Forum, which called attention to what they called the fragile water bubble that was about to burst on the world, with all of the some of the consequences we were just discussing. But they also emphasized, quite rightly, and something that Jeff referred to before, the linkage between water security, energy security, food security, and the umbrella that overlaps that, which is climate change, because climate change exacerbates the water crisis in very severe ways because it manifests itself through water, through floods, droughts, melting glaciers, etc. So the group in Davos represents large businesses and some political leaders. And so once it gets on their radar, and they are very big users of water around the world, some of these corporations, we begin to get we move the dialogue forward to make awareness a little greater.
Well, as you talk about, I don't know whether we have to compare, but there have been the haves and have-nots as far as oil was concerned. Are we moving into an era where there are going to be haves and have-nots as far as water is concerned, Jeff?
Well, I think we will, in a warmer world, see big changes in where water is and in many respects, when it comes. So the simple rule of thumb may be that in a warmer world where there's a lot of water now, there's going to be more, and where it's dry now, it's going to be drier. But even it's even more complicated than that, in the sense that some places may have the same amount of water over, if you had a yearly average, but they may get it in intense periods that make it very difficult to capture, rather than more evenly spaced out that you could see would be much more useful for a farmer, for example. So that's there's going to be change in the system in terms of amounts and where and how we can capture it or fail to capture it. I think there also are lots of questions about where water is and isn't and the prospects for transferring within, but that's a whole very place-specific and very different depending on where you are.
Steve.
Yes, I know. I actually see rather I see it happening even without the global warming. Global warming makes it pretty sharp and worse, but I think we see a number of divides. We see it in food. There is going to be approximately 3.6 billion people living in countries that can't feed themselves in about 15 years from now. So there will be a divide between those countries that can feed themselves and those who have to import food.
Where do you see those countries?
The Middle East. Already, the Middle East imports 50% of its food because it doesn't have enough water to grow its own food.
And India is the big one that's going to tip the scale. And when India goes, because they're overpumping their groundwater now to the extent of something like a quarter of their food production, if I'm not mistaken, we face a situation that there's going to be competition on the world market for food, and you're going to see spikes in food prices, which is going to harm the poorest people in the world the most. And so there's a great inequity also built into the structure of the water crisis.
What about the amount of rainfall, snowfall that we on the Earth are getting at this point? Is that also confined to certain areas? And are those areas going to be the wealthy in terms of both water and food, Julia?
When you look at the maps of what's expected with the changes in precipitation, there are some areas where there will be increased average precipitation, and that is mostly in richer countries, in northern climes, and in Russia and sort of the former Soviet Union countries. And the poor countries are almost universally the ones that show up red on those maps as having a reduction in average precipitation. But like we were saying, that masks the increase in variability. Abu Dhabi does fine, right? It knows it doesn't get much water. It desalinates its water. It does fine. So having an average very low amount of precipitation is okay if you know you're going to get it. The problem comes if you're expecting some water and then you don't get it. And I think that this issue of inequality and water increasing inequality is actually very, very important.
You touched on the word that probably perked everybody's ears off, desalinization. Is that why people are paying less and less attention to water, even as they pay more and more attention to oil? The possibility that you could desalinate water and therefore provide enough for the entire globe?
Well, it takes a lot of energy to desalinate water. And so if you live on the coast, or if you live on an island especially, then it's got a lot of potential. And as the technological advances move forward, it's very likely that it will become cheaper and cheaper and more reasonable to desalinate water for urban populations. The problem comes for agriculture. If you need it, water is always heavy. And so it costs a lot of money to move it inland, especially if you have to go up a hill. And so it's difficult to see that you could desalinate seawater for agriculture. You could desalinate brackish groundwater for agriculture.
Julia Bucknell, she's manager of the Central Water Unit at the World Bank. Short break. When we come back, your calls, questions. Stay with us. As we talk about water and the fact that many people believe that gold is going to be less valuable than water in the future, I'm talking with Stephen Solomon. He's a journalist and author of the recently published book titled Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. Julia Bucknell, she's manager of the Central Water Unit at the World Bank, and Jeff DeBelko, he's director of the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. Just before the break, we were talking about the possibility, the prospect of desalinization of water and whether that might indeed solve the problems. Steve Solomon, you wanted to add to that.
Yes, two points. First, the source of the energy that we use to desalinate water is critical. And if you're burning fossil fuels, which we are currently, you're adding to the global warming problems. This shows the trade-offs between, again, energy, water, and climate change. The second point is that the base amount of we're starting from a very low base of capacity for desal. So even as the technology improves, and hopefully somebody will get the Nobel Prize and figure out how to do this with solar or wind.
And do it cheaply.
But even then, it's going to take a while for a build-out to occur that could meet the needs of that we have currently and in the foreseeable future, so that we really have to face the fact that we need to improve the existing productivity of the water we've got, use it more efficiently and also fairly, and in a way that protects the ecosystems. It's an organization. We were talking about that before. It's an organization. It gets back to organization problem around the world.
Of course, here in this country, we don't use water efficiently, do we?
We are probably the most profligate water user in the world. We also happen to have a great amount of water. And I contend in this book, Water, that we could be really a water superpower for the world and providing much of the food of the productive water-intensive industrial goods if we would take the steps necessary to be as efficient, let's say, as in Australia or Israel are with their water.
And how are they so efficient with their water?
Well, they've become efficient because they faced, of course, very arid and very difficult conditions, including, in the case of Australia, very severe climate change, probably influenced droughts. But they reorganized their agricultural sectors is one of the major steps. In Australia, they revised the entire water rights regime and allowed and put into place that water rights can be traded. In fact, they're even traded over mobile telephones. They actually were able through the drought to I think maintain the level of production that they had prior to the drought, if I'm not mistaken, and in Israel, for example, they've also they're using wastewater that is not been treated to a level that is drinking potable water level, is considered gray water, and then they're funneling that down into the farms where it can still be used. So they're using they have two networks of water systems in place.
And Julia Bucknell, explain the role of the World Bank in this whole water issue.
Well, we work on several fronts. We work on the services area, so we take very seriously the basic needs agenda, the millions of people who don't have access to water supply and sanitation in urban and rural areas. We finance improvements in the systems and increases in access, and we help countries figure out ways to make that sustainable financially so that they can maintain those systems themselves.
So, for example, would you have worked with Australia in trying to streamline and improve its water situation?
We don't lend money or work. We don't work with Australia because it's not a borrowing country. It's too rich, essentially. But we work actively with Australia in learning from what they're doing and trying to bring the lessons to other countries. And in China, for example, there is some fantastically interesting, you know, genuine leapfrogging work going on to try and bring water rights idea into China. On the very early stages, you know, building slowly up towards what they've got in Australia. But actually, I think they'll end up taking it further and doing it in an even more advanced way.
Give me an idea of how China is dealing with this.
Well, they are using remote sensing technology based on NASA data. They're using remote sensing technology to measure how much water each individual farmer uses, taking it from the sky, so that you don't have to go with individual monitors on each farm. And then it's very clear to the farmers how much water they're allowed to use. And they have these little credit cards that measure the pumps that say, you know, this is your limit. And at the when you've used up your limit, the pump stops pumping. And they're literally using the remote sensing technology based on NASA data and taking it down to the individual farm level and saying, this is how much you can use. And they say in return for not over-pumping the groundwater, the bank is helping, giving them alternative technologies, changing their crops so that they can get more value for the water that they do pump in return for them pumping less.
So, but China itself would have the technological ability to move in that direction. What about the countries of Africa?
Well, we do similar things there too. The great thing about some of this new monitoring and information technology is that you can patch together The physical data that you have on the ground, which is very sparse in Africa and in most of our borrowing countries, with the satellite technology, which is the same everywhere, and with models, with kind of estimates, and that you can patch these things together and make genuine advances. And then we're doing a lot of work with visualization data so that you can look at the impacts of one type of investment on other parts of the basin. And it works even in these very capacity-poor and data-poor environments. So we're seeing some really exciting new innovations in that field.
Yeah.
Diana, I think it's interesting that we've talked about Israel, Australia, and China as places where we're seeing innovation in approaching these sorts of, where crisis and water shortages, as well as the water quality issues, particularly in China, are pressing those governments and those peoples to take this issue on head on. And so, one, it's interesting the role of crisis and understanding of crisis as a motivating factor, of course. But then it goes beyond that, and our political institutions and political leaders have to not kind of deal short term and then pretend things are going to go back to a state of normalcy, but to progressively and proactively shape and reshape the institutions and some of these technological specific ideas, as well as taking a hard look at the subsidies and the way we've done things in the past and looking for ways that that's counterproductive as our water future will change. Having a broad view of the connections to other areas. So, for example, in the United States, in a decision to subsidize biofuels based on corn-based ethanol, with frankly too little attention paid to what that means for our water future and our water tables and the fact that they're already shrinking higher rates.
So we have our own sustainability problems.
Absolutely. And it's, of course, masked by the fact that we do have a lot of water and it doesn't necessarily come to us in ways, those scarcities don't come to us as obviously as they do in Australia and
Steve.
Israel.
There is one thing that's been happening, though, in the United States and through the industrialized democracies that is worth mentioning. We've had, for the first three quarters of the 20th century, the United States actually consumed three times more water than the population growth. But from about 1980 on, it actually has the amount of water that we're using is flatlined, and the population has continued to grow by about 30%, and the GDP continued to grow. So there has been a water productivity boom happening. And the reason it's been happening, one of the reasons it's been happening, is that we did put in the clean water regulations that affected a certain portion of our society, and it made a cost. It made water more costly because you had to return the water in a clean state to the environment. And surprise, surprise, you know, businesses started to innovate and find ways to use less water. And cities began to recycle water and so they wouldn't have leakage. But there is a whole segment of our economy that is unregulated for pretty much for supply and for pollution. And that's largely the agribusiness sector and as well as certain other sectors.
And don't you have areas of this country that are dry? I mean, I'm thinking about Las Vegas or Phoenix that could go dry.
They could. Of course, they're among the most innovative of the areas already, and in some sense, a little bit of crisis is a good thing.
I'm happy to hear that. How have they been innovative?
Well, as we say, they do that. Like Israel, they do an awful lot of recycling of their wastewater. They put in gardens that we're talking about an urban environment here, but they're putting in gardens that are filled are natural gardens. That is that use the desert landscape. There's actually have a water police, I believe, that go around making sure that people are watering at the right hour, which means in the evening when it's not going to evaporate so fast. Things like that.
Does that make sense to you, Julia, in terms of preserving the water that we do have in this country, as we've said before? People are profligate in other areas.
It certainly makes sense that this country could do a better job of managing what it has. But there's equally a lot of innovation to learn from here too. I mean, like you said, this is a country that is able to enforce rules and set rules. It may not seem like it, but compared to many other countries, it is able to do that. And there are some innovative ideas out there. I mean, I wish that there were as many people thinking up solutions to the water problem as there are thinking up clever, you know, banking, clever ways of doing the banking.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of clever people working on it. So
what about the condition of our water infrastructure, Stephen?
It's pretty old. We built a lot of this back in the 19th century, some of it, and there are big leaks. There's a great, people probably don't even know, New York City, underneath New York City is Tunnel Number 3. They've been building for about 50 years. And should it not be completed, and the reason they're building it is because Tunnel Number 1 and Number 2, which distribute the water throughout the city, are really old, and they're afraid they haven't been able to go in and do maintenance because they're afraid that it would shut down and they would lose, New York would become uninhabitable. So they've been building this multi-billion-dollar project deep under the ground, slow by slow. And it looks like we're going to make it, but we've been facing sort of a slow motion potential cataclysm.
How long does it take to complete?
They started about 1970, I believe. I could be wrong exactly.
And they're still at it.
They've had a few interruptions with the financial crisis. Very expensive.
And just to remind our listeners, Stephen Solomon is a journalist. He's author of the recently published book titled Water: The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. Julia Bucknell is manager of the Central Water Unit at the World Bank. Jeff DeBelco is director of the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've got lots of callers. We'll open the phones now. 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Santa Ana, California. Good morning, Sam. You're on the air.
Good morning. I made a documentary on this subject called Blue Gold, World Water Wars, which is based on Maud Barlow's book, Blue Gold. She is the first UN advisor to water. And I wanted to call in because, as you see from your guest, many people are finding innovative solutions to the ultimate crisis. But we also need to look at the politics, and people need to be very wary about who controls their water and that we don't allow our governments to sell the water rights to private corporations under the guise that they're going to solve these problems. The film deals with cases all over the world where that's led to it's always led to price increases, sometimes half of people's salary in Bolivia. Where the people actually had to rise up to protest, and the government, which had been corrupted by the money they made, sent the military out with snipers shooting down people to protect the company's interests.
All right, Sam, thanks for calling. Julia, on the Bolivia question.
Okay, yeah, this is a very difficult issue. I think we should make a distinction between the ownership of the water and the responsibility for managing the infrastructure. Both of them are very important, but in almost every country in the world, the ownership of the water remains in the government's hands, and it's the private sector corporations that are sometimes asked to manage the services. And in some cases it goes well, and in some cases, like the one that you're citing, it goes badly. It depends on the governance structure, the way that the contracts were written, and a host of factors. In the last 15 years, I think everybody's learned a lot more about how one can involve private sector efficiencies and drives to the benefit of the services whilst controlling some of the less desirable aspects.
Jeff.
Well, I think I agree with Julia. I think it's a complex mix that one can't just tar the whole issue of privatization versus public with bumper stickers. I think it's also indicative, as the Cochabamba case illustrates, that this is real high politics, and it's about political stability and economic stability, as well as this kind of the notion of what water is providing in a household or such. This is high politics. In this case, it wasn't. It wasn't a high level of casualties. One person was killed. But those protests, which became protests for a larger set of political issues, actually were a big part of bringing down two successive governments. So in that way, I think the gentleman used a frame that's commonly used, water wars, which I frankly find less useful, because really the evidence of countries fighting countries over water is very, very thin. However, there's lots and lots of violence around water, but it's within countries, and it's in a variety of different aspects that can't simply be reduced to the kind of bumper sticker of water wars.
One of our emailers, Jerry, says Wendy Barnaby wrote an article in Nature over water wars. She concluded nations don't go to war over water. This would seem to challenge the major national security assumptions about water and water availability. Stephen.
Well, first of all, there's been very good work, and Jeff has done a lot of it, on showing that cooperation is certainly, when you're facing, both of you are facing a loss of your water, it brings your minds together very quickly, and you really get down to brass tacks and find it that you can actually build on the water as a form of the cooperation. I do think, though, that the emailer should look at the greater danger of really a failed states countries that can't feed themselves or can't deliver the basic water services, public health needs, and therefore that leads to regional instability and other problems that are national security issues.
Stephen Solomon, his new book is titled Water, the Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, a story of science, ethics, race, and class. It's about Henrietta Lacks, a poor African-American woman who died of cervical cancer in 1951. Her cells were cultured and became the first human cells to reproduce well. They were used for tens of thousands of experiments without the consent or knowledge of the family. Join us.
As we talk about water, its availability, concerns about water, here's an email from Aram, who says, I'm hoping you'll talk about the danger that hydrofracking, that is natural gas drilling, presents to the domestic supply of fresh water in terms of norm contamination. Stephen.
Yeah, this has been a very controversial because it's looked like it may be one of the solutions to the energy problem. And there's a large deposit of runs up from Pennsylvania to New York called the Marcellus Shale that there's been a lot of drilling in. But it looks like it's also getting into the groundwater. And New York City worked out a deal with the company that's doing the drilling not to drill in the New York City watershed just for that reason. It goes also to the larger question of also regulation of our drinking water, more generally speaking, where we've had a great regression in the progress that we had made to the point, I think the New York Times did a series recently, investigative, that shows that 40% of our drinking water supplies now are contaminated and 20 million people a year are getting sick from it. I mean, you talk about the healthcare debate, you want to start with something important, just start right there.
Exactly. Here's another email from Rick. He says, could your guest please comment on potential conflicts between India and China as they compete for the Himalayan watershed? Jeff.
Well, it's certainly a fascinating case that Himalayan. A friend makes a joke that seems like every river originates in the Himalayas, but it's not every river, but it's an awful lot of them. And the populations in South Asia, India, and East Asia, and China and Southeast Asia, are highly dependent. You can get different numbers, but you're talking 1.5-2 billion people. There is, I think, illustrative of this point that countries have not gone to war over water. We just saw in the Financial Times in the last few weeks an agreement between China and India, two countries that aren't necessarily terribly friendly, to come together and study exactly what is happening to their glaciers and their snow melt and the seasonal snow melt, because it has tremendous implications, economic, political, social, the whole range, because there is an awful lot of change there, as we've seen already in terms of glacial melt increasing. And anticipating that it will happen faster with climate change. And so I think there are prospects for tensions. I would suggest in that region, it's more likely questions about migration that might come from Bangladesh into India that is part of a water story, has a water story behind it, has a poverty story behind it, multiple reasons that people would move, that it's those ways that water is part of situations where we might see violence, rather than between these two countries that have so many reasons not to use conflict to settle their water problems. But frankly, water is just really difficult to go get through war. It's hard to pick it up and take it home. You know, so in that sense,
it's heavy.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Stephen.
I think the case of Pakistan is a good summary case for many of the issues that we've been talking about. This is a country that we know that is a nuclear-armed country that has problems with the Taliban besieging it. It has salination problems, but it's completely dependent on this Indus River for most of its water. It has all the population growth problems that many of the countries have that have water problems. It's going to be growing 30% or so in the next number of years. At the same time, the Indus is shrinking by about a third of its volume because it gets half of its water comes from the glacier. The glacier melts that we were just talking about. And so as the glacier's disappearing, they're facing a scissors, a population pressure on the one side, and on the other side, the loss of the water. So the United States actually just did a $7.5 billion aid package over a number of years to Pakistan. The largest portion of it and the most immediate portion is focused on their water problems. Mm. Can we help on irrigation, can storage, hydropower? You know, frankly, if Pakistan fails as a state, we've got the nightmare failed state scenario. So this is critical.
Yeah, it's obviously very important. There are many people can see the world through different lenses, and one can see it through many different lenses. There are people who see it through a population lens. We happen to see it through a water lens. But there's no doubt that water is a very important part of this thing. And I think in the Middle East, that generally there's many countries. Yemen has probably the most severe water crisis in the world and is a country that we are watching struggling with its overall political governance issues. I mean, they have their population centers up mountains inland, and they're depending on groundwater that is literally running out.
And here's an email from Lisa, who says, would your guest comment on whether certain wealthy interests have been going into countries and buying water sources so that native people will not have rights to their own country's water? Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I would perhaps focus on the kind of related question. I'm not sure it's exactly what Lisa has in mind, but we do see in this food security context the development of countries that are food insecure taking steps of buying or leasing land in third countries to guarantee that they have food imports, which is essentially importing water in the form of virtual water in terms of food. And some of those attempts to buy land have had politically destabilizing factors and have become an issue about equity for, in some instances, places like Madagascar that are very poor and very food insecure. And so in that sense, this kind of water equity issue comes through agriculture.
Julia.
I think we should remember one thing about water is it doesn't get used up or go away in some sense. It gets recycled. It goes somewhere else. It's difficult to buy water that flows in some ways. However, there are some cases where they have what we call, what some people call fossil water, which are the kind of large stores of water underground. And in those cases, sometimes, let's say a company gets a big mining concession, that uses water today that will not be available in the future. And that's one of the things that in the World Bank we work on. We're trying to find equitable ways that you can develop, as in get the economic benefits of the mining, but at the same time not harm the indigenous people or the people who live there, the poor people who live there now.
All right, let's go to Jorge, who's in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, I had the opportunity to hear the eminent environmentalist Dr. Peter Raven in a speech he was giving at Webster University about 2 years ago, and he was addressing various global warming issues, and among them was the water situation, and he said some places on the planet will literally become without any water, not one drop, and when this happens, you're going to have hordes of people moving wherever they can find water, and this is going to create major problems because they're not going to understand or care about borders, which is understandable. They're going to just be looking for water. So he said that's going to be the next major problem for the planet is the shortage of water and what's going to happen to the millions of people that just don't have any.
Julia.
Environmental refugees is a big research topic. It's difficult, like many things, it's difficult to pinpoint exactly why people move. But it is definitely a factor. And you do see that when agriculture, for example, becomes unsustainable, people migrate to the cities or they migrate to the nearest developed country. And there is no doubt that agriculture, especially rain-fed agriculture, is going to get less reliable. So we will see, I think, more people choosing to do other things because the advantages of what they're doing now become less and less.
Jeff.
I absolutely agree. I think it's important in this instance to not just focus on absolute scarcity. So it's not necessarily the case that the very driest will have the most people and the biggest problems. It's intimately connected to the rate of change. So how much experience do those populations have with dealing with dryness, and do they have adaptation strategies to work? Where you import food or you have crops that are more drought resistant and such. But the fact that in a warmer world we expect more variability, more surprises, means that this will become a bigger problem, puts the onus back on our political institutions and political leadership to be flexible, to be forward-looking, to anticipate these changes, all things that are difficult to do.
State.
Yes, much of our water infrastructure around the world is also wrong-sized for the changes that are coming from global warming.
Wrong-sized.
Wrong-sized, because it's built for a climate where we had, let's say, snowpacks that melt in the spring, fill up the reservoirs, and then release the waters in the dry seasons, in the summers. Well, if more precipitates as rain, you get more runoff earlier, mudslides, other problems of that sort that can create environmental refugees in some places, or But then in the summer, there's not enough left for the crops, for hydropower. And so we're facing around the world, depending if you're a country like the United States, we can probably adjust to it. It's difficult. But in countries that don't have much infrastructure, this is a life and death question.
Let's go now to Grosse Pointe, Michigan. Hi there, John.
Good morning, Diane. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
To your guests, you know, a subject, everybody talks about the oil in Iraq, but if I'm not mistaken, the Tigris and Euphrates is the greatest amount of fresh water that exists in that region. I wonder if your guests had any comment about the politics and the use of it by Saddam to damage the lives of the marsh people and that sort of thing. Do you have any comments regarding that?
Julia.
Yeah, it is. And the Tigris Euphrates is the main river that runs, you know, Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. And it's a very important lifeline for all of those countries. And that is the area where, when people talk water wars, that's where the tanks actually did once come out in the 1970s. They never actually fired, but that's where it got closest, I think. So you're absolutely right. It's a huge hotspot. Everybody knows it's a huge hotspot. It's incredibly difficult to manage. There's a lot of effort going on to try and monitor what is happening with it. And it's both a quantity and a quality issue, because all the irrigation in Turkey and Syria upstream means there's a quality issue in downstream as well. Mm. And it's a perfect example of how water is used But when the governance is bad, how water has been used under Saddam to control populations and politics.
Yeah, I cover this in the book, Water. The Shiites, he was punishing the Shiites in that case for the uprising after the first Gulf War. The point also is that Turkey is the Middle East really a water superpower now. It controls both the headwaters of both of those rivers that we talked about. And the fate of how much water goes down into Syria and Iraq is really in Turkey's hands, just as in China controls we were talking before with Jeff about the Tibet, by controlling Tibet, controls the Mekong and other great rivers, and how much is going to get downstream there in the future. So where you one of the divides we're seeing in the have-have-not divide is who are the upriver states who in history have usually been those been able to call the shots versus those that are downriver. And we're seeing it playing out on the Nile even right now, where Egypt has been the exception to the rule, but looks like it's losing its grip a little bit and is having to cooperate now a little more, because Ethiopia, which supplies almost all the water for Egypt, has been able to get some leverage.
All right. To caller here in Washington, D.C., Murad, you're on the air.
Good morning. I had an observation to give and a question to conclude. The observation I have is with regard to this last comment made, and that is the whole issue of desalination, as far as it is technology-driven, goes directly to the heart of the haves and the have-nots, because to the extent that the haves control the technology, the fear on the part of the have-nots of this world is that that control will deprive them of a vital resource. The question with which I want to conclude is, have any one of your panelists heard of or come across the work of Michael Salzman and his book New Water for a Thirsty World, as well as the work of Adolf Erik Nordenskjöld, 1901, for which he was nominated in his work in water resources? He was nominated for the Nobel Prize in Physics. I'll take my answers off the line. Thank you for taking my call.
All right, Steve.
Well, I'll have to confess I don't know those the references of the caller, but I would say this, that if the United States really wanted to be constructive in engaging, and we're really not very engaged at the moment in this water crisis problem, we could do several things, and the technology is one of those. There could almost be a water peace corps, if you will, in addition to improving our own productivity by going out into making sure we helped regions around the world join in basin agreements to share and make technology available. We could probably increase our leverage, our standing in the world, and give comfort to some of the concerns.
And you are listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Dale, who says, Michigan lawmakers are trying to put all water in Michigan into a public trust. People are worried that all users will be taxed for all water we use, a strange concept in the middle of the largest source of fresh water in the world. Please comment, Steve.
Well, the Congress, of course, did approve the Great Lakes Compact in 2008, which essentially we did see a number of the stakeholders get together who had been fighting for years over the water to come together and say we're going to do certain things to preserve, help preserve the Great Lakes. But there's a condition. You can't take the water out of the Great Lakes Basin. This was ratified by Congress. I suspect that anybody who's around the edges of that basin might be concerned about that fact.
But aren't we all taxed on the water we use? I mean, here in the Washington area, the Washington Sanitary Commission puts a tax on the water that we use for maintaining the structure for everything else in the reservoirs and the like?
Well, I think there's great variability in the degree to which their people are paying for actually for the water itself. We do pay for the delivery of the water. And I pointed out also that agriculture pays virtually nothing, if anything, for the use of the water.
I see.
The city rates will vary.
Finally, I think everybody wants to know, how long will our water be available and safe? Steve.
In the United States, are we speaking of? Well, if we take care of it, we should be fine. But right now, it's as I say, we are not. The EPA has not been doing its enforcement; has not kept up with the latest chemicals that have come into the water system.
And around the world, Julia,
it depends on the governments and it depends on private sector and people managing it well.
Julia Bucknell of the World Bank, Stephen Solomon, his book is titled Water, the Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. Jeff DeBelko of the Wilson Center. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.